protesting that Paoli was being argumentative. Sustained, Judge Townsend agreed. You became friends with Cecilia Washburn, didn't you? Paoli spat. I would not describe her as a friend, Nurse Francoeur replied. How would you describe her? As a patient. You said that part of your responsibilities as a medical professional was to refer her to a lawyer? You referred her to an Atlanta law firm, did you not?
I gave her a name, Francoeur explained.
And you made contact with that law firm on her behalf, didn't you?
I did not.
You had made contact with that law firm to tell them that Ms. Washburn was going to be calling them?
It was not me who made that contact.
And this was about the time that Ms. Washburn was going to go to the police department, isn't that right?
I believe it was before then. I don't recall the exact date.
Let me remind you when she went to the police, March 16th. And you know that because you went with her, isn't that right?
That's correct.
Paoli professed that he was shocked that Francoeur, a nurse, would accompany a patient to the police station or refer a patient to a lawyer. In a voice edged with scorn, he inquired, "That's part of your medical professionalism?" Francoeur replied that such consultation was part of providing patient-centered care, in accordance with the standard protocols of her profession. "Patient-centered and litigation-fueled, is that part of what it is?" "Objection!" shouted Dirk.
"Sustained," Judge Townsend concurred.
Paoli nevertheless continued hectoring Francoeur about referring Washburn to a lawyer for several more minutes. "And it is part of your professional practice to refer your patients to lawyers in Atlanta?" he fulminated. "Is that right?"
"It's part of my job to refer them to whatever resources they need," she wearily replied, "including attorneys."
Finally realizing that he had perhaps dwelled overly long on this point, Paoli stopped badgering Francoeur about the propriety of referring an alleged victim to a lawyer and started badgering her about the way she performed Cecilia Washburn's forensic exam. Paoli even suggested that it was not Jordan Johnson who caused the injuries to Washburn's genitalia, but Francoeur, when she conducted the examination. As evidence of her ineptitude, he pointed out that the finger of one of the surgical gloves she wore had a minuscule rip. "The torn glove is really outside the standard of care, isn't it?" he asked.
"It's outside of the standard, yes," Francoeur agreed.
Paoli brought up the laceration inside Washburn's vagina that Francoeur had identified in the video. "This small laceration, it's approximately a millimeter, isn't it?" he asked.
"I'd have to look at the tape again," she answered. "But that sounds about right, 1 to 2 millimeters.
"I mean, it's tiny, correct?"
Paoli continued.
"Yes." When he inquired if the laceration could have been made prior to the alleged assault, she said yes. "Even up to a week before, isn't that right?" he asked.
"It would be rare to see injuries up to a week before, but it could be."
Paoli asked if the tenderness and abrasions Francoeur had found on the wall of Cecilia Washburn's vagina and the red marks she'd identified on Washburn's collarbone could have been caused by consensual sex.
"It's possible," Francoeur conceded.
When David Paoli finally completed his cross-examination, prosecutor Adam Dirk was given an opportunity to interrogate Nurse Francoeur again. "In terms of your care and treatment with Ms. Washburn, did you maintain your objectivity?" he asked.
"I did," she replied.
"Did your examination of Ms. Washburn cause any of the injuries, either the genital or the non-genital injuries?"
"No."
"Did the way that you conducted this first-step acute sexual trauma examination violate any guidelines that you're aware of?"
"No."
"Do these guidelines, the 2004 national protocols, talk about your duty to provide information about civil attorneys to a victim?"
"They do."
"Do these national guidelines tell you that you are supposed to help victims communicate with law enforcement officers?"
"They do."
"Was there anything in Cecilia Washburn's history that indicated to you that these injuries were caused prior to February 4th, 2012? Prosecutor Adam Dirk asked.
"No,"
Nurse Francoeur replied. "Objection, Your Honor," defense counsel David Paoli protested.
Judge Townsend asked Paoli and Dirk to approach the bench for an off-the-record conference to discuss Paoli's objection. As the lawyers were leaving the bench after huddling with Townsend, Paoli muttered something under his breath to Dirk, a threat or imprecation, apparently, because Dirk turned toward Paoli and angrily demanded, "Excuse me? What was that?" Paoli said nothing, but he stood chest to chest with Dirk, glaring down at him. For a long beat, Paoli, who probably weighed at least 100 pounds more than Dirk, looked like he was about to deliver a headbutt to the bridge of Dirk's nose. Townsend diffused the standoff by pointedly declaring, "You may continue, Mr. Dirk," after which Dirk resumed his redirect examination of Francoeur, and Paoli retreated to the defense counsel's table. "Did the torn glove affect the ultimate findings of your examination in this case?" Dirk asked. "No," Francoeur replied. Cecilia Washburn's genital injuries, she assured the jury, were consistent with sexual trauma. Connie Bruckner, the Missoula police detective assigned to be the lead investigator for the Jordan Johnson case, was called by the prosecution to testify in support of Cecilia Washburn. Under direct examination by prosecutor Adam Dirk, Bruckner testified that Cecilia Washburn had cooperated fully with her investigation, including voluntarily turning over her cell phone and allowing the police to download all of the 29,000 text messages it contained, many of which defense counsel David Paoli used in court to try to smear Washburn's reputation. To some degree, Johnson also cooperated with Bruckner's investigation, but suspiciously he deleted all the texts about Washburn he'd sent in the aftermath of the alleged rape, before Detective Bruckner had an opportunity to ask for them. And because Washburn didn't go to the police until 6 weeks after the alleged rape, Johnson's cell phone carrier had deleted his texts from its system by the time Bruckner began her investigation. 3 months after the night in question, Bruckner and another detective named Dean Christensen interviewed Jordan Johnson at the police station in the presence of defense counsel Kirsten Pabst. As an adjunct to Detective Bruckner's testimony during the trial, Dirk played a videotape of this interview. As they watched the video in the courtroom, the members of the jury heard Detective Christensen admonish Johnson. "There's two people in that room together, and one of you is lying. Your behavior after the incident, that, to me, is the most alarming part." "What's more," Christensen said, "Johnson had plenty of reason to lie, because if he were convicted, it would end his dream of playing professional football after college, or becoming a football coach." Upon hearing this, Johnson began to sob. "I don't care about all that," he told Christensen. "I just want to be a kid again. I don't care about football." At one point in the video, Johnson told Detective Bruckner that he said almost nothing to Cecilia Washburn from the time they started making out on Washburn's bed until she dropped him off at his house after the alleged rape, and she spoke to him only once. Washburn playfully uttered, "Oh, you're bad," Johnson recalled, "when I turned her over." As soon as he uttered these words, however, Johnson seemed to regret admitting that he'd turned her over, and he quickly added, "Well, we changed positions." After the video ended, prosecutor Adam Dirk asked Detective Bruckner if she'd found this bit of testimony significant in any way. "I did," she said, explaining that Johnson's statement corroborated Washburn's testimony that she was turned over by Mr. Johnson. When defense counsel David Paoli cross-examined Detective Bruckner, he asserted that when Cecilia Washburn was on the witness stand 9 days earlier, Washburn had testified that she assisted Jordan Johnson in changing positions. Bruckner countered that Paoli was misrepresenting Washburn's words. Washburn had in fact testified that Johnson said, "Turn over or I'll make you," and then she'd said, "And then at that point he grabbed my hips and flipped me over. I just knew I was going to get raped. I did assist him, but it was because I gave up." As Detective Bruckner shared Washburn's testimony with the jury, however, Paoli abruptly cut her off because he didn't want the jurors to be reminded of what Washburn actually said. Instead, Paoli wanted to elicit testimony from Bruckner that would support an argument he'd been making for much of that afternoon, that Detective Bruckner had been negligent in her sworn duty to seek exculpatory evidence, that is, evidence that might show Johnson's innocence, during her investigation of the alleged rape. Earlier in his cross-examination, Paoli had said, "Detective Bruckner,
I know that you take your job seriously. And tell me what the main goal of your job is.
To find the truth, she said.
And justice?
He asked.
Yes. How do you do that?
I do interviews, Bruckner answered. Gather evidence, try to corroborate the person's statement, or refute it.
Try to find exculpatory evidence?
Yes.
You're required to be impartial, are you not?
Yes.
It would be improper to develop a relationship with the complaining witness, isn't that correct?
Paoli asked. I would need you to define relationship.
Well, at any time did you know that Miss Washburn was talking to this Atlanta litigation law firm prior to coming in and making her report? Did you have any idea, or did Claire Francoeur indicate to you in any way that she was thinking about not reporting to the police until she talked to the Atlanta law firm? Has Miss Washburn ever told you that she had obtained the services of a law firm out of Atlanta?
No, Bruckner answered.
Detective Bruckner, Paoli demanded, you have been involved in the Department of Justice investigation of the Missoula Police Department, isn't that correct? You have given a statement or been interviewed? And when did you give that?
I don't know, June maybe?
It was shortly after the DOJ announcement to the media, Bruckner answered. So that was in the midst of your investigation in this case, correct? Did that DOJ interview make an impression on you?
Yeah,
Bruckner affirmed. I thought it was a really positive conversation. And did it cause you to redouble your efforts on this case?
No. I had done plenty of work on the case prior to that interview, and it didn't affect me at all.
David Paoli interrogated Detective Bruckner in this fashion for an especially long time, intending to demonstrate to the jury that she had developed an improper personal relationship with Washburn, causing Bruckner to shirk her responsibility to dig for evidence that might prove that Johnson had been falsely accused. Quoting Article 10 of the Canons of Police Ethics, Paoli asked, "As a law enforcement officer and a lead detective, you shall be concerned equally in the prosecution of the wrongdoer and the defense of the innocent. Isn't that right?"
"Yes," she answered.
He wondered how she squared this ethical duty with a police department policy enacted the previous March. The new protocol required Missoula cops, when initiating a sexual assault investigation, to believe the victim's claims until the evidence demonstrated otherwise. "You would agree with me," Paoli demanded, cloaking his assertion as a question, "that this policy destroys the objectivity and impartiality of police investigations, doesn't it?"
"No," Bruckner answered. "Not at all."
Riled by her response, Paoli protested, "You can maintain your objectivity and impartiality even though you're required to believe the accusation until it's proved otherwise?"
"That's part of the investigatory process, to gather evidence to corroborate or refute somebody's statement," Bruckner calmly replied.
Missoula Chief of Police Mark Muir drafted the new policy, she explained, as a result of some issues in the community. "So community pressure caused the new policy to be instituted?" Paoli asked.
"I don't know about that," Detective Bruckner answered. "I think it brought awareness to potential problems."
The new policy was intended to help patrol officers respond better, she explained, by providing them with guidelines for investigating sexual assaults more effectively. Defense Counsel David Paoli's fixation on the new police policy came with a backstory. As his co-counsel Kirsten Pabst had mentioned in her opening statement on behalf of Jordan Johnson 11 days earlier, the new policy had been formulated in response to a pair of Missoulian articles Gwen Florio wrote in January 2012 about sexual assault victims Carrie Barrett and Caitlin Kelly and the way the Missoula police handled their cases. Florio's reporting prompted City Councilwoman Cynthia Woken to invite Chief of Police Mark Muir to participate in an open forum that would give the public an opportunity to ask questions about his department's response to Missoula's rape crisis. When the forum was convened, Muir admitted that the department would benefit from more definitive sexual assault procedures, and that the victim needs to be our priority. Cops, he said, should treat victims the way the cops themselves would want to be treated under the exact same circumstances, to give every victim that same compassion. And then he pledged that within 6 weeks he would enact a better policy with respect to sexual assault. After Chief Muir spoke,
Carrie Barrett took the microphone to slam both the police and the Missoula County Attorney's Office for their mishandling of her case and Caitlin Kelly's case, reserving her harshest words for Kirsten Pabst, who was in charge of prosecuting rape cases for the Missoula County Attorney's Office at the time. True to his word, Muir put the new police policy into place soon thereafter, on March 19, 2012, which happened to be 3 days after Cecilia Washburn went to the Missoula police to report that she had been raped by Jordan Johnson. It also happened to be 18 days after Pabst quit working as a prosecutor to start her own law firm. After Kirsten Pabst resigned from the Missoula County Attorney's Office, she joined David Paoli as defense counsel for Jordan Johnson. When Pabst and Paoli blamed Carrie Barrett and Caitlin Kelly for the new police policy during Johnson's trial, and used the new policy as a cudgel to batter Detective Bruckner and her investigation of the alleged rape, it was perhaps a sensible tactic, a potentially effective application of lawyerly artifice. But Pabst and Paoli reacted to the new police policy with a degree of outrage that suggested that Carrie Barrett had gotten under their skin, and they considered it a personal affront. Actually, the question of whether the new police protocol trampled Jordan Johnson's constitutional rights had already been argued by both sides, and the matter had been resolved by Judge Townsend 2 weeks before the trial even began. After their initial motion to dismiss the Johnson case had been rejected by Townsend in September 2012, David Paoli and Kirsten Pabst had filed a second motion to dismiss in early January 2013, arguing, "The Missoula Police Department's policy requiring officers to initiate investigations into sex crimes with the belief that they are true violates the presumption of innocence and due process and led to a completely biased investigation of Jordan Johnson." "The rule in criminal cases is clear," Pabst asserted, citing a 1957 Montana case, State versus McLeod. "Every presumption in favor of the defendant's innocence shall be indulged until the evidence establishes his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt." In a response brief filed by the prosecution, however, Deputy Chief Missoula County Attorney Susie Boylan exposed glaring flaws in Pabst's claim, pointing out that Pabst had neglected to mention other important aspects of the new policy, which require police officers to obtain the information necessary to determine a crime is being alleged and establish whether a crime occurred. "There is nothing unusual about assuming an initial report of a crime is true and conducting an investigation to determine whether sufficient evidence of a crime exists for possible prosecution. That is standard procedure, whether the crime is a sexual offense, an embezzlement, a robbery, or any other case. The reason for specifically institutionalizing this is the historically skeptical treatment of victims of sexual offenses that has not existed for victims of other types of offenses. Every victim of a crime should be heard and a thorough investigation conducted. The policy merely reflects that notion." More importantly, the defendant is asserting a right he did not have at the investigative stage. "The presumption of innocence is not a specifically enumerated constitutional right. It is a doctrine embodied in the right to a fair trial. In other words, it is a trial right." To buttress the prosecution's argument, Boylan cited a 1979 U.S. Supreme Court case, Bell v. Wolfish, and a 1994 military case, U.S. v. Dickey. "The role of presumption of innocence is often confused by laypersons and courts. The presumption of innocence is a rule of evidence for the courtroom that defines a part of the accused's due process rights. It does not control the pretrial functioning of law enforcement officials, commanders, or magistrates." After considering Kirsten Pabst's motion to dismiss and Susie Boylan's response, Judge Karen Townsend wrote, "The court finds that the Missoula Police Department's policy is not in violation of the presumption of innocence. It is not improper for the police to have this policy because, as Dr. David Lisak noted in his expert witness disclosure, the percentage of false rape reports is very low. The purpose of an investigation is to look for evidence of a crime as well as evidence of innocence. It is not until the time of trial that the defendant is entitled to the presumption of innocence. It is hereby ordered that the defendant's second motion to dismiss is denied." So Pabst and David Paoli lost this skirmish. But now that the trial was underway, Judge Townsend's rejection of Pabst's motion to dismiss the case was irrelevant. Here in the courtroom, with Detective Connie Bruckner on the witness stand, Paoli was free to argue all over again that the new police policy was unfair. and in order for the prosecution to win the current battle, it wasn't an erudite judge whom Prosecutor Adam Dirk needed to persuade. He had to convince the 12 laypersons seated in the jury box, none of whom had gone to law school, that the new policy did not infringe on Jordan Johnson's constitutional rights or taint Bruckner's investigation. To accomplish this, when Paoli finished his cross-examination for the defense, Dirk handed Detective Bruckner the portion of the new Missoula police policy that had gotten Paoli's knickers in such a twist, and asked her to read it aloud to the court. "A victim's distress," she began, "may create an unwillingness or psychological inability to assist in the investigation. Officers and investigators play a significant role in both the victim's willingness to cooperate in the investigation and ability to cope with the emotional and psychological aftereffects of the crime. Therefore, it is especially important that these cases be handled from a non-judgmental perspective, so as not to communicate in any way to a victim that the victim is to blame for the crime. Every sex crime investigation is to be initiated with the belief it is true until evidence demonstrates otherwise." Dirk pointed out to the jury that the language Paoli found so outrageous was based on guidelines published by the International Association of Chiefs of Police, which recommended that all sexual assault reports should be taken as valid unless evidence proves otherwise. When Dirk asked Detective Bruckner why the new policy was important, Bruckner answered that it acknowledges what a sensitive topic this is, and how difficult it is for victims to come forward. She explained that the policy helped prevent police officers, during their initial contact with rape victims, from derailing the cases by inadvertently alienating the victims and scaring them away. The policy, she declared, gives the victims a voice in the process. "Police routinely presume that victims of other crimes, such as burglaries, are telling the truth," Dirk noted. "If you refuse to believe a victim in the beginning of a case," he asked Bruckner, "would any crime ever get investigated in the first place?" "No," she answered. Chapter 26. Before the trial began, defense lawyers David Paoli and Kirsten Pabst submitted a list of 25 individuals they intended to call as character witnesses for Jordan Johnson. But Judge Townsend declared that having so many people present evidence of his good character would be a waste of time, and ruled that only 5 character witnesses would be allowed to testify. Michael McGowan, who ran a Missoula private equity firm and was the team chaplain for the University of Montana football team, was the first of the 5 to appear on the witness stand. McGowan testified that Johnson participated in all of the services that I offered. Although McGowan had never attended seminary and did not have a divinity degree, on game days he provided a voluntary chapel 30 minutes before the kickoff. "Many of the players participate," he explained, "but not all. He would perform blessings, pray for their injuries to heal, lead the team in prayer before they ran onto the field, and then lead another prayer after the game. In addition," he said, "during the week, I make myself available if someone has an injury or they have some issues they want to discuss. My interactions with Jordan Johnson have been always in a group setting," McGowan acknowledged. "He's very respectful, unassuming, and a young man of integrity. He's not a very boisterous or vocal person. He's very, very cool under pressure." "Johnson," McGowan added, "does not use expletives. I have never heard Jordy actually swear, which is, frankly, unusual." McGowan marveled over the fact that Jordan can handle his emotions probably better than I can, which is unique for someone of that age. "In very stressful settings," McGowan explained, "he's able to basically rein those in and keep himself contained, which I think is self-control." When David Paoli asked if McGowan had ever observed Jordan Johnson acting entitled, McGowan replied, "I have not seen that." "How about antisocial?" Paoli asked. "I have not seen that." "Self-absorbed?" "No." "Hyper-masculine?" "No. That's the antithesis of his character. He doesn't draw attention to himself in a group or individual setting, from my observation," McGowan testified. "Is he narcissistic?" Paoli asked. "No," McGowan answered. A moment later, Prosecutor Susie Boylan began her cross-examination by asking Mike McGowan if he knew the scientific definition of the terms antisocial, hypermasculine, and narcissistic? Or are you testifying just based on sort of your common understanding of those words? Common understanding, he admitted. Referring to McGowan's role as a volunteer chaplain for the Grizz football team, Boylan asked, You don't spend any time alone with the players, is that right? I have really no need to, McGowan answered. And you therefore haven't spent any time alone with the defendant, right? I have spent time in a group setting with him, for instance, sitting on an airplane or at a meal, but never a one-on-one setting. And you never talked to him about his love life, correct? No. And he hasn't confided anything to you? No, he hasn't. You gave us some pretty nice attributes of the defendant, but you would agree that someone with those attributes could still do something bad or wrong, right? Boylan asked. Well, I gave you my observations, McGowan answered. Right, Boylan said. But when we spoke to you on the phone in your pretrial interview, did you tell us that you're not saying that someone with those attributes, meaning the positive attributes you just described, can't do something bad? That is what I said. Boylan's cross-examination was unexpectedly effective. It served as a provocative reminder that even individuals we admire can have skeletons in their closets. At 4:10 in the afternoon, after 27 minutes of testimony, Mike McGowan was excused, and the most highly anticipated witness of the entire trial took the witness stand. The defendant, Jordan Johnson, wearing a pale blue button-down shirt with an open collar. Defense counsel Kirsten Papps began by asking him about his family. Johnson described growing up with his parents and an older sister in Cobourg, Oregon, a tiny community beside the Willamette River, just outside of Eugene. He spoke about his relationship with his father, Marty, a math teacher and coach, as special. I was lucky enough to have him as my football coach in high school football. I think we're a lot closer than most fathers and sons. When Pabst asked Johnson what activities he did with his mother, he replied that mostly they just spend time together. She helps me when I have to find presents for people. She goes shopping for me. Is it fair to say you're very close? Pabst asked. Yes, Johnson answered. Your whole family is pretty close? Very, he said, in an emotional voice, momentarily losing his composure. As Jordan Johnson testified, he revealed himself to be taciturn and self-possessed, confirming what Mike McGowan had said about him. In answering Pabst's questions, Johnson seldom said more than yes or no, and he almost never uttered more than a few words at a time. His reticence left space for others to imagine whatever traits they wished to see in him. At times he seemed cold and somewhat aloof, but it was easy to like Johnson, and hard not to feel sorry that he was in this predicament. Do you get easily embarrassed? Pabst asked Johnson. Yeah, he answered. Have you always been like this since you were a kid? Yes. Are you more talkative now than you were when you were little? No. Just before 5 o'clock, after Johnson had spent just 45 minutes on the stand, the court was adjourned for the evening, and Judge Townsend reminded everyone that there would be no proceedings the next day, because the trial was in recess every Tuesday in order to allow Townsend to take care of other court business. When the trial reconvened on Wednesday morning, February 27, 2013, Townsend announced that Jordan Johnson's testimony would be interrupted briefly so that a character witness, Rudy Herr, a pastor who'd flown from Oregon to testify on Johnson's behalf, could finish his testimony in time to catch a plane home. Herr had been Johnson's youth pastor and the coach of his ninth-grade football team. He had known Johnson since Johnson was 5 years old. Herr stated that he'd studied the Bible with Johnson, and that his son was one of Johnson's childhood friends. Rudy Herr told the jury that despite Johnson's impressive accomplishments as a football player, he doesn't carry himself like he's the greatest thing to ever walk the earth. Johnson was honest, truthful, and has incredible self-control, Herr testified, echoing what almost everyone else had said about Johnson's ability to remain calm and perform well when the stakes were high. Under cross-examination by prosecutor Joel Thompson, Herr acknowledged that Jordan Johnson had told him about the rape accusation during a short conversation the previous summer, and had said the sex was consensual. Thompson asked Pastor Herr if consensual sex without a condom was morally acceptable to him. I was disappointed, Herr admitted. 16 minutes after taking the stand, Rudy Herr was excused, and Jordan Johnson resumed his testimony. Defense counsel Kirsten Pabst began by asking him, What was your impression of Miss Washburn? Johnson answered, That she was a really nice, smart girl. Did you like her? Pabst asked. I liked her as a person. I didn't like her as, like, a girlfriend type, like, he replied. Do you think she liked you? Yes. Pabst asked Johnson to describe what happened on February 4th, 2012, starting from the time he woke up, and he gave an account of what transpired over the 14 hours that followed. Most of the details were in accord with the account Cecilia Washburn had provided to the jury 2 weeks earlier, and Johnson answered Pabst's questions in the assured, practiced manner of someone who had already told this story numerous times during the University of Montana disciplinary investigation and the criminal investigation leading up to this trial. Washburn's testimony had seemed equally well rehearsed for the same reason. But if their stories were much the same, they couldn't have been more at odds in describing what happened between approximately 11:20 and 11:30 on the night of February 4th, when Johnson and Washburn were fooling around in her bedroom. Johnson's account began to diverge sharply from Washburn's at the point just after he'd pulled her shirt off, with her permission, as they were lying on their sides face to face. According to Johnson, We were still kissing, and then I take her pants off. How did you do that? Pabst asked. She arched up a little bit to help me get them off, he explained. Did she show any reluctance at that point? No. Did you touch her anywhere? Yeah, in her genital area. Over the clothes or under the clothes? It was when she had underwear, just underwear, on. I touched her on top and underneath. How did she react to that? She liked it. And how do you know? Because she wasn't resisting in any way and she was still kissing me. At any point did you take off her bra? Yes. Did she seem interested in that? Yes. After you took off her bra, did you touch her breasts at all? No. Was there a point where she touched you? I don't remember. You don't remember her touching your crotch? No. At some point, did you have a discussion with her? She asked if I brought a condom, Johnson replied, but that was after we were both naked. So then what happened? Pabst asked. Then I got on top of her, and she asked me if I had a condom, and I said no. And she said, it's okay. So then what did you do? We had sex. In what position? Missionary. And did she show any reluctance when you were having sex in this position? No. If she would have, I would have stopped. Did she seem upset during any of this? No. How long were you having sex with her in that position? Probably 2 or 3 minutes. And then what happened? Then I pulled out. Why did you pull out? Because I thought I was going to ejaculate. What did you do after that? I didn't ejaculate, and we changed positions, Jordan testified. I started to turn her over, and she knew what I was doing, and then she said, Oh, you're bad, in a kind of giggling tone. So did she turn around and look at you? Pabst asked. Yes. And what did she say? Oh, you're bad. In a kind of teasing voice? Yes. And what did you take that to mean? That she liked it. Then we had sex in that position for about the same amount of time. And did you think she was into it? Yes. She was moaning. Was she lubricated? Yes. And what did you do? I pulled out and ejaculated into my hand and on the bed. So how long did the total sex part of it last? 5 minutes. And at what point did she say no? She never said no. How do you know that? Because she didn't. I would have heard her, and I would have listened to her, and I would have stopped, Johnson said. Do you know what she was thinking? Pabst asked. No. Did she ever fight you off? No. Did she ever push at you? No.
Did you tear her pants off?
No.
Did you grab her hips?
No.
Do you think she had an orgasm?
I don't think so.
Why not?
I honestly have no idea, but that's just my guess.
After you pulled out and you said you ejaculated in your hand, what did you do after that?
I asked her if she had something to clean it up with. She grabbed the hand towel.
And why did you want to clean it up?
Because I didn't want it on the bed or on my hand.
According to Johnson, Washburn got out of bed pretty much right after he asked her for the towel.
Did you ask her then to come back onto the bed to snuggle with you?
Pabst inquired.
No, Johnson answered.
Cuddle?
No.
Did you kiss afterwards?
No.
Did you say anything to her like, that was great?
No.
Why not, Jordan?
I don't know. I just didn't.
What was going on in your head at that point after you ejaculated?
Well, I asked her for something to clean it up with, and as I was cleaning it up, she started to put on her clothes, and so I put on my clothes, and then I went into the bathroom because I had to go pee.
While he was in the bathroom at 11:41 p.m., Cecilia Washburn sent the much-discussed text to her housemate Stephen Green, indicating that she'd just been raped. Kirsten Pabst, not surprisingly, made no mention of this text as she questioned Jordan Johnson. She did, however, ask Johnson to describe what happened after Washburn left the bedroom. He said, "I put on the rest of my clothes, my shoes, and walked out past Stephen Green and got in the car with Cecilia."
"Did Cecilia seem upset at all?"
Pabst asked.
Johnson answered,
"No."
"So what's going on in your head?"
"I was kind of starting to think about Kelly Froland and that I didn't want her to know that I had sex with another girl, because I really liked Kelly."
"At the point where you got into the car for Cecilia to give you a ride home," Pabst asked, "did you anticipate a continued friendship with Cecilia?"
"I didn't, really," Johnson confessed, "but he thought it was possible that they would talk again."
"How were you feeling about the evening?"
"That we had sex and that afterwards I wish we wouldn't have because of Kelly."
"So did you talk at all on the ride home, the 2-minute ride home?"
Pabst inquired.
"No,"
Johnson said.
When Pabst asked what happened after they arrived at his house, he answered,
"I said, thanks for having me," and got out of the car.
Then he went into the house and went into my room.
After Pabst finished her direct testimony, Prosecutor Adam Dirk strode to the dais to cross-examine the witness. He asked if Johnson thought Washburn was smart, and Johnson said yes.
"You thought she was a nice girl, correct?"
Dirk inquired.
"Yes," Johnson answered.
"And you never really thought of Cecilia Washburn as a good friend? You didn't know Cecilia Washburn very well through any of this, is that fair?"
"Yes."
"But you liked her. You went out on a few dates together?"
"Yes."
"You didn't see anything in Cecilia Washburn that indicated to you that she was mean?"
"No."
"You didn't see anything on those dates that made you think that she was crazy, correct?"
"Correct."
Adam Dirk pointed out to Jordan Johnson that he never really had a boyfriend-girlfriend relationship with Washburn. "And the relationship that you did have, to the extent one existed, you didn't really think it was going anywhere. In fact, you thought it was going nowhere, correct?"
"Yeah."
"Now, in terms of your relationship with Kelly Froland, there was a relationship there. Fair?"
"Yes."
"You went on dates with Kelly?"
"Yes."
"You brought her over to your house?"
"Yes."
"So she met your family?"
"Yes."
"Nothing like that ever happened with Cecilia Washburn, correct?"
"Correct."
Dirk paused for a moment, then asked Johnson about the sex that took place when Washburn was kneeling on the bed, face down with her buttocks raised as he penetrated her from the rear. "While you're having sex with her from behind," Dirk inquired, "your hands are on Cecilia's forearms, correct?"
"Yes," Johnson answered.
"Her arms are above her head, correct?"
"Yes."
"All your weight was in your hands, correct?"
"Most," Johnson hedged. Dirk asked Johnson to look at page 42 of the statement he gave to Detective Bruckner on May 2, 2012. "I'm looking at your third answer down," Dirk said. "I'd like to read your statement, and please tell me if I've read it correctly, okay?"
"Okay," Johnson said.
Dirk recited, "But all my weight is in my hands." Dirk looked up at Johnson and asked,
"Did I read that correctly?"
"Yes," Johnson acknowledged. Launching into a series of brief, piercing questions, Dirk asked, "So her hands are above her head, correct?"
"Yes," Johnson calmly answered.
"Your hands are on her forearms."
"Yes."
"You're penetrating her from behind, and all your weight is on your hands?"
"Yes."
"So she was pinned to the bed, correct?"
"I don't know."
"You had your hands on her forearms, and you were holding her forearms down, correct?"
"Yes."
"And you're behind her, correct?"
"Yes."
"All your weight is on those forearms, correct?"
"Yes."
According to his official Grizz publicity profile, Jordan Johnson's height was 6'1", and he weighed 200 pounds. As he sat on the raised witness stand at the front of the courtroom, Johnson's heft and muscular physique were unmistakable. Appraising Johnson with an accusing gaze, Dirk asked,
"You're a big person, correct?"
"I don't know," Johnson answered. "All your weight was in your hands?"
"Yes."
"So you were pinning her down. Is that fair?"
"Fair."
"So she was pinned to the bed, correct?"
"I guess."
"And you said nothing at this point?" Dirk asked.
"Right."
Before the trial, Cecilia Washburn had testified that at this particular moment during the alleged rape, Johnson had angrily declaimed, "You said you wanted it! You said you wanted it!" But Dirk couldn't share this information with the jury because the prosecution had asked for and been granted a judicial order prohibiting the defense from mentioning that 24 hours before the alleged rape at the Foresters Ball, according to Johnson and his friend Alex Bieniemann, Washburn told Johnson, "I would do you any time." If the prosecution asked Johnson about telling Washburn, "You said you wanted it," the defense would have been allowed to bring up the fact that Washburn had allegedly offered to have sex with Johnson any time. So Dirk simply asked Johnson, "You didn't talk to her at all during this, right?"
"Correct,"
Johnson answered. "Then you pulled out and ejaculated?"
"Yes."
"Now, during sex, everything seemed normal to you?"
"Yes."
"You didn't have any sign that she was reluctant in any way, and if she had said anything like, 'No, not tonight,' or indicated in any way that she wasn't completely into it, you would have stopped and asked her what was going on, right?"
"I would have just stopped."
"But nothing seemed weird to you at all?" Dirk inquired.
"Correct," Johnson answered.
"Nothing seemed weird to you during the sex?"
"Correct."
"Nothing seemed weird to you after the sex?"
"Correct."
"She seemed fine to you. According to your testimony, she wasn't upset at all this entire time, correct?"
"She wasn't."
"Okay. And you would have known if something was wrong?"
"Yes."
"Mr. Johnson," Dirk asked, "Cecilia sent a text message within minutes after you penetrated her, correct?"
"Yes," Johnson answered.
"She sent this text right after the intercourse was over?"
"I believe so."
"You've seen that text message?"
"Yes."
"And that text message had a time and date stamp on it, correct?"
"Correct."
"This text message said, 'I think I might have just got raped. He kept pushing and pushing. I said no, but he wouldn't listen. I just want to cry. Oh my God, what do I do?' Correct?"
"Yes."
"Now, this was the first time that you'd had sex with Cecilia, correct?"
"Yes."
"And let me just make sure I've got this straight," Dirk said. "You really had no conversation the entire time?"
"Correct,"
Johnson replied. "This is your first time with Cecilia?"
"Yes."
"And your first time you pinned her forearms to the bed, correct?"
"My hands were on her forearms."
"Okay, you admitted that before. So you pinned her to the bed, right?"
"Yes."
"After the intercourse, you left?"
"She drove me home."
"And on that ride home, you claim nothing was wrong with Cecilia, right?" Correct. And you said that you would have known if something was wrong.
Yes.
Having methodically led Jordan Johnson to the edge of the cliff, Adam Dirk asked the question intended to nudge him into the abyss. You would agree that something is clearly wrong when someone sends a text message indicating they've just been raped, right?
I don't know, Johnson said.
You don't know?
Dirk scoffed.
Correct, Johnson answered. Incredulous, Dirk demanded. That seems normal to you? If someone sends a text indicating they've just been raped?
That's not normal, Johnson admitted.
That is not normal, Dirk affirmed. Then he asked, you would agree that if the events of that night had happened as Cecilia described it, this text would make sense, correct?
If it happened, Johnson agreed.
But it didn't. If it did not happen as Cecilia described it, Dirk countered, this text would be completely crazy to send, correct? And you said that you had never seen any indication that Cecilia was crazy before this night happened, correct?
Correct.
You would agree that if a woman says no, and a man does not stop his sexual advances and penetrates her, that is rape, correct?
That's true.
You would agree that a woman can change her mind in the middle of sexual activity and still say no?
Yes.
You would agree that if she physically resisted, you did not have consent, correct?
Correct.
You would agree that if she put her knees up to stop you, you didn't have consent, correct?
Correct.
You would agree that if you held her down with your forearm, you did not have consent.
Correct.
And you have no explanation for the bruising on her chest or shoulders? Objection, Your Honor, Kirsten Papps protested. That misstates the evidence. There is no bruising.
I don't think that misstates the evidence, Judge Townsend pronounced.
Overruled. Resuming his interrogation without missing a beat, Adam Dirk again asked Jordan Johnson if he could explain the bruises on Cecilia Washburn's chest and shoulders. Johnson acknowledged that he couldn't. You'd agree that if you held Cecilia's head down while you penetrated her from behind, that would indicate you did not have consent, correct?
Dirk asked.
Correct, Johnson replied. You'd agree that if you bruised her genitals or injured her genitals, that may indicate you did not have consent, correct?
I don't know.
You'd agree that if you had said, turn over or I'll make you, you did not have consent.
Correct.
Thank you. I have nothing further at this time. Jordan Johnson was excused from the witness stand at 11:15 Wednesday morning after testifying for 157 minutes, including his appearance on Monday. His father, Marty Johnson, was called to testify a little after 2 o'clock on Wednesday afternoon. Under gentle questioning from defense counsel Kirsten Papps, Marty said he was midway through his 30th year coaching football and teaching math to high school students in Eugene, Oregon. How close is your family? Papps asked.
I can't imagine there being very many families that do as many things together as we do, Marty answered. So I would say we are extremely close.
As his father spoke these words, Jordan wept openly in his chair at the defense counsel's table. He cried intermittently for the remainder of his father's testimony, at times putting his head in his hands or resting it on the table. How often do you talk to Jordan? Pabst asked.
Probably more than he would like me to, Marty answered. I communicate with him multiple times every day.
How would you describe his personality?
He's quiet. He's an extremely humble kid. Very, very respectful.
A few minutes later, Marty added,
I'm like any parent. I'm proud of my kids. But my livelihood is being around adolescents, young adults, high school age kids. And I can say, with my right hand to God, I haven't been around a more honest young man than Jordan. I just feel lucky to have him as my son.
Have you noticed changes in your son since this allegation was lodged? Pabst asked.
Jordy is an extremely strong and resilient young man, but it's had a huge effect on him. Huge effect.
What effect on your family?
It's short of losing a child, I couldn't imagine a worse situation to have this kind of accusation about a kid of his background. I don't know. Maybe there are stories of things that are more devastating, but I wake up every day feeling suffocated. And it's been that way for 13 months now.
Prosecutor Adam Dirk realized that cross-examining such a sincere and immensely appealing witness would only be counterproductive for the prosecution. So after 15 minutes on the stand, Marty Johnson was excused. At least 3 or 4 members of the jury looked like they were on the verge of breaking into tears as he walked back to the gallery, where he sat beside his wife for the remainder of the trial. Chapter 27. The final 2 witnesses, one called by the defense, the other by the prosecution, testified on Thursday, February 28, 2013. The defense witness, a psychiatrist and neurologist named William Stratford, had never examined Cecilia Washburn, but he'd reviewed her counseling and medical records at the University of Montana's Curry Health Center at the request of David Paoli and Kirsten Pabst. Stratford argued that although the records indicated that Washburn suffered from anxiety and depression in the aftermath of her sexual encounter with Jordan Johnson, the symptoms she exhibited did not rise to the level of post-traumatic stress disorder. The prosecution witness, David Bell, was a physician at the Curry Health Center who treated Washburn after she was allegedly raped. He testified that the symptoms she displayed matched all the criteria for PTSD. Friday, the first day of March, was the trial's final day. More people were jammed into the gallery than on any previous day. 5 television cameras bristled from tripods next to the jury box. Most of the Grizz football team and many of the coaches were present. Jordan Johnson's family sat on the east side of the gallery. Cecilia Washburn and her family were seated on the west side. Prosecutor Susie Boylan began the state's closing argument by saying the case was about the differences between being raped by a stranger and being raped by someone you know and trust. It's a case about the difference between science and myths. It's not about football or the university or misunderstanding or miscommunication or mixed signals. And it's not about an insensitive lover that didn't cuddle enough. It's about a defendant who didn't take no for an answer. No one with a heart, Boylan continued, could fail to be moved by some of the testimony in this case, from the defendant's father, for example. It's okay to have that sympathy. It's okay to find the defendant or his dad or their supporters likable. But you can't acquit him because of feelings. You can't acquit because you feel for the defendant and his family, any more than you can convict because you feel for Cecilia and her family. The state has to prove the elements of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt. This is not beyond a shadow of a doubt or beyond all doubt. To prove something beyond all doubt or beyond a shadow of a doubt would require a camera or all of us being there as the situation unfolds. Conflicting accounts are not automatically reasonable doubt. It is not fair to a victim, or to a defendant for that matter, to be judged based on myths, misconceptions, or stereotypes. But that's exactly what the defense is hoping that you'll do. So Dr. David Lisak was here to dispel some of those myths and misconceptions. That's what experts do. Lisak had pointed out that rapists can be men who are good-looking, who are likable, charming, gentle, and even timid, Boylan reminded the jury. He made it clear that there is no profile of a rapist. Nobody can be ruled out. Good people can do bad things. Washburn had stated that when she was being raped, it felt like a dream where you want to scream but you can't, Boylan said. She described being in complete shock. When she texted Stephen Green, "I think I might have just gotten raped," Washburn wasn't confused about whether she had been raped or not, Boylan asserted. She told us, "I was sure I got raped, but I didn't want to believe it," one of the classic responses described by Lisak. A person who commits rape, Boylan said, especially one like this, is the person who's in control. He's in control of the time, the place, the victim. But the rapist can't control everything, Boylan told the jury. And those things he can't control are what you should be looking at. Although most rape victims don't report what happened to the police, Jordan Johnson couldn't control whether Washburn would be in that small fraction of women who do choose to report. He couldn't control that she sent that text. He couldn't control how her body would show signs. Johnson, Boylan continued, left 2 kinds of marks on Cecilia Washburn that night. The physical marks and the psychological marks. And those marks tell you a story of what happened in that room as surely as if a camera had been in there. The first is the mark he left on her chest. He had no explanation for it, but it was there. The genital injuries, as you have seen, can be explained away in many ways. Boylan conceded that these wounds were not a smoking gun, but the trauma Washburn experienced left an unmistakable psychological mark. Call it PTSD, Boylan said. Call it long-term anxiety, call it whatever you want. The defense can deny the diagnosis, but they cannot dispute the symptoms that everybody in her life has seen. Before February 4, 2012, Boylan noted, Cecilia Washburn was vibrant. She was social. She was outgoing. She didn't take medications. She didn't see a counselor. She was a normal young woman who earned a place in a highly competitive and very demanding academic program. After February 4th, she struggled. And it has been absolutely established that Cecilia Washburn changed drastically after February 4th. Washburn, Boylan said, is not the hysterical drama queen the defense would have you believe she was prior to February 4th. Jordan Johnson's attorneys, Boylan explained, need you to believe that Washburn conforms to a very obvious stereotype of a woman that's hysterical, vengeful, and deceptive. The crazy woman they warn you about. But that's not who you met in this trial. Rape, Boylan pointed out, is the only crime in which the victim is presumed to be lying. If a person was mugged in an alley, she asked the jury, would we be skeptical of the victim's testimony because there weren't any eyewitnesses? Would we doubt the victim of a burglary, Boylan wondered, because they left the door unlocked? The victim is the wrong person to blame, she argued, whatever the crime. It's the offender who needs to be held accountable. There was reason to believe that Jordan Johnson was a decent young man, Boylan acknowledged. But he committed a crime. The jury had been presented with all the evidence they needed to give Cecilia the accountability she deserves, she said. We humbly ask that you convict this defendant of sexual intercourse without consent. Defense counsel David Paoli's truculence in the courtroom could be grating. But even his harshest critics would probably concede that the unflagging intensity of his advocacy for his client was an extraordinary feat. When Paoli stood at the dais and began his closing argument, his defense of Jordan Johnson had consumed his life for the previous 13 months. His complexion was ashen. He needed a haircut. Puffy folds of skin drooped beneath his eyes, and his jowl sagged heavily over his starched collar and the knot of his yellow tie. He looked like he hadn't slept for a year. Despite his exhaustion, or perhaps because of it, Paoli's summation was delivered with manic energy. Words flew out of his mouth like panicked bats hurtling from a cave. Justice needs to be fought for, Paoli declared. The truth needs to be fought for. The truth does not require an explanation. The truth does not require an expert from Boston. Jordan Johnson has completely denied Cecilia Washburn's account, Paoli asserted. The prosecutors stand here and take a big chunk of their opening to talk to you about the expert from Boston who's here to be educational and how he's more smarter than all of us. And then, on the other hand, they even encouraged you to use your common sense, except when it comes to the Boston expert. He knows better. I thought it was condescending and presumptuous for them to say to you, he knows so much more about this, so you need to listen to him. I don't buy that. The judge instructed you to use your common sense, and I hope you will, because common sense is what's needed in this case. Paoli's assault on Dr. David Lisak was relentless. The Boston expert was needed because there's so much to explain here. They want to call it counterintuitive. Ridiculing Lisak's explanation for why rape victims often failed to flee or scream or fight back when they were assaulted, Paoli warned the jury not to be fooled. When people are afraid, he asserted, they run. That's common sense. That's not expert stuff from Boston. A few minutes later, Paoli said, I want to talk to you real quickly about the environment in which we're trying this case. It's intense. These people are under intense pressure, and the police are under intense pressure. The Department of Justice is talking to Missoula County Attorney Fred Van Valkenburg and his staff, and we know about the police department policy, a special policy that was instituted as a result of political social pressure. It was the only police policy, Paoli asserted, that deprives people of their constitutional right to due process. And we all know from civics that that just isn't right. That's not what this country is. Paoli asked the jury a rhetorical question. Do you believe, Miss Washburn, beyond a reasonable doubt,
Even the people who know her best doubt her. I'm not being mean, he said. I'm just being factual.
Citing the text message in which Cecilia Washburn said, I think I might have just...